Welcome to the Matt Haycock Show, a podcast about business, money, and life. Matt has been making money and making mistakes for over 20 years. And in this podcast, he shares his thoughts and stories so you can improve your business, finances, and life, whilst hopefully avoiding the mistakes he and others have made along the way. Listen in and level up.
And you see today, you know, people wandering around, not wearing the face mask properly, not actually socially distancing properly. And I can understand that. I mean, people are fed up with the advice they're being given.
Hey, guys, welcome to another episode of the Matt Haycock Show. I'm Matt Haycock here today with a guest who regular viewers and listeners may have seen before, Dr. Alan Watkins. For those of you that don't know Alan, Alan's a neuroscientist and a polymath, and he runs a consultancy working with some of the world's biggest companies advising on leadership. Alan and I originally met, virtually met 6 or 7 months ago at the beginning of lockdown, when we were talking specifically about Corona, lockdown hadn't happened, I don't think, when you and I were first talking, Alan. And I think I interviewed two or three people just to get a better understanding of the virus and what was probably to come. Although what we spoke about probably at the time probably bore no resemblance to what has actually come and what's continued to play out. So thanks a lot for joining us again, and really excited to listen to you and pick your brains. I have got many questions, as I'm sure the people are going to be asking as well, but maybe I'll throw it more openly over to you to see what you've been up to, what your thoughts are and how things have panned out differently over the last 6 or 7 months compared to what you and I initially spoke about and what we thought was to come.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Matt. It's a real pleasure talking to you. Really enjoyed our conversation back in March. And just to reinforce, I like a good heckle. So if anybody has got any questions on, frankly, any topics, you know, we can go in any direction, because I think it's just more interesting. I mean, the world's a complicated place these days, and, you know, people have got questions bubbling up all the time. And so I'm more than happy to veer in any direction the audience wants. I have been pretty busy down during lockdown. I've been writing 3 books in addition to, continue to run the company. In many ways, a sort of viral pandemic is kind of particularly interesting to me because, as you know, I trained as a physician, was a jobbing physician for 12 years. So I sort of got the medical angle. There's a lot of mental health implications we could touch on. And I've got a degree in psychology, so I'm really fascinated by that. And I've got a PhD in immunology, so an immunology of the lungs to boot, which is basically where Corona takes its home. So Corona is almost like a perfect triangulation of my 3 degrees. So I've been pretty fascinated with the quality of advice or poor quality of advice from lots of people in many nations and the consequences that have played out as a result of that poor quality of advice. And it really has played out. Some of the things that have happened since March have been entirely predictable. And some of the things are slightly surprising. So we can get into that.
So let me jump in with a question then, which I guess comes off the back of you saying some of the things that have happened since March are entirely predictable. And I guess everything I'll ask is asked completely from a layman's perspective. So in the chronology of coming out of lockdown, lockdown happens. I say allegedly, because let's go off the government stats that are released. We stem the outbreak off Corona. Lockdown then finishes, and what is almost like a surprise from Parliament is, oh my goodness, the outbreak is now spreading. We need to try and contain things more. So again, for me, something that was entirely inevitable was that if we are not locked down, then of course the outbreak is going to spread. It's going to spread greater. It's going to continue to spread. I mean, is that too simplistic a comment or too simplistic an answer? I mean, what was, because my view is, well, unless we're going to be locked down in entirety for the rest of our lives, then this virus is going to continue to spread.
Entirely predictable, and many people did predict it. When you get the kids back to school, I mean, they're fantastic infection hubs around schools, and people start to ignore the social distances, of course, not helped by you know, many people within the government itself ignoring its own advice, Dominic Cummings and the like, you know, setting a really bad example. And so, of course, it's going to, you know, recur. So that was entirely predictable, despite what the government was saying. So I don't think it's too simplistic what you're saying. You know, it was obviously it was going to recur if we weren't as locked down as we were before. We're getting what we deserve.
Does that mean we should never have locked down in the first place and just accepted it, or should we have always expected almost like, you know, sporadic lockdowns? I guess like you know, tapping on the brake occasionally when you know when you're on the motorway freewheeling.
Well, we just have to be more disciplined. I mean, I think it's very interesting when you look around the world as to what's happened in different countries around the world, because the stats are very, very different than they are in the UK. And we tend to take an extremely parochial view in the UK. I mean, you see very little information on the media about comparing what's happening in different countries and the strategies they're using in different countries. We don't see enough of that type of information. So, for example, you know, during the main peak earlier on this year, if you compare New York with Hong Kong, New York's slightly bigger population than Hong Kong, and New York had something like 23,000 deaths and Hong Kong had four. I mean, literally zero, four. And you think, well, all right, the first response is that can't possibly be true. The data must be incorrect. You know, they're lying to us. But even allowing for that, there is a huge disparity. And partly you have to get underneath the story. And again, this has been widely covered in, you know, some of the more enlightened media outlets. Is they took a way more disciplined approach to social distancing, mask wearing, you know, gloving up, you know, washing your hands, all of the things that we're now latterly being told is important. They did that in Hong Kong right from the get-go because they had SARS, and so they learned what it meant, you know, to actually protect themselves. In information sharing of where the hotspots were happening. Despite not through the government sources, by the way, through the power of the people themselves. And we just haven't been that disciplined. I mean, there's been a laissez-faire attitude. So it was right to lock down. But, you know, when we started to come out of that, we came out with, I think, too much of a laissez-faire attitude. And you see today, you know, people wandering around, not wearing the face mask properly, not actually socially distancing properly. And I can understand that. I mean, people are fed up with the advice they're being given.
I mean, I was going to say, I mean, I guess there's probably a lot to do with the contradictory and the inconsistency of advice. I mean, you know, like we talk about masks, and you know, let's ignore for a minute whether or not, you know, people like wearing them. You know, if you ask six experts, you're going to get six different answers as to whether or not masks actually work. You know, yes, they work. No, they don't stop you catching it. Yes, they stop you spreading it, but no, they don't stop you catching it. You know, and then obviously there's different thicknesses of mask, different styles of mask, etc. I mean, you know, taking the mask as an individual item, you know, I mean, how useful in the prevention of spread is that?
Well, I mean, look at Hong Kong, four deaths. They massively masked up. I mean, anybody, even pre-COVID, you know, would travel in China. People just wear masks a lot more frequently out there anyway. You know, and if you look at some of the infection rates in Asia, they're way lower than we see in many countries in Europe that didn't mask up. You know, so, I mean, I you know, remember doing a webinar way back in March saying masks are going to be here to stay. So, the government advice was, as you just indicated, was going up and down all the time. Again, no, masks will be a thing and they will become really important for the rest of the year, if not through into next year. I mean, I said that back in March on a webinar myself, you know, and this is where we are. There's something interesting about, which we could talk about, the sort of cult of the expert, is that we tend to, you know, turn to, you know, people, you know, experts for an expert view. But the trouble is the experts we're talking to are too, you know, their focus is too narrow. They don't see all the wide implications and therefore become over-reliant. And then we get a sort of battle exactly as described on, you know, one expert versus another expert. And what we need is, you know, to pull back and get some a range of people in the room collaborating effectively together, because these things are pretty complicated, Matt. And we're relying on single point experts who see it from a very narrow perspective, and that is a mistake.
I mean, who's making the decisions for Boris? I mean, is Boris making his own decision ultimately, or is the, you know, a very narrow group of advisors?
I think it's a narrow group of advisors. Again, difficult to be sure because there's so much deliberate confusion and misdirection going on. I mean, you know, politics is sort of awash with it. I mean, politics for me has now become synonymous with sort of deceit, distraction, distortion, disruption, discrediting, displacement, doubt, and discarding points of view. What I call in one of my new books, the seven deadly arts of deception. And politics is awash. I mean, it's impossible now to see a politician on television who isn't using one of these seven deadly arts to, you know, basically confuse people. You know, so you have to sort of get beneath the surface. I mean, I suspect that Boris is not making the decisions, that he's getting advice. And again, this has been widely reported. The level of incompetence we're seeing from political leadership, not just in the UK, by the way, globally, is quite staggering in many nation states. So there's a, in my view, a sort of a political regression and sort of ethnocentric divisiveness. So politics and political leadership is going backwards globally at the moment, and that's a major problem.
Now, I mean, whether or not it's realistically possible to do so, I mean, do you see this as something that should have been dealt with kind of centrally, globally? You know, right. So that there's a, you know, there's a global set of rules for lockdown, yeah. Or do you think it's all right country by country?
I mean, it's really interesting, Matt. Again, if you pull back from the specific pandemic that we're experiencing right now, there's a wonderful woman called Elizabeth Sartorius, who's an evolutionary biologist, very wise individual. And she tells a lovely story, which is if you look at the two most successful species on the planet, it's Homo sapiens and bacteria. And the reason we're the most successful species on the planet is because we collaborate. So if you look at the evolution of all living things, it took bacteria about 1 billion years to realize it's more energy efficient to collaborate than to kill. So bacteria, before there were any kind of complex organisms on the planet, bacteria were sort of ruling the reefs for about 1 billion years. And after about 1 billion years, it sort of occurred to bacteria, oh, maybe we better collaborate. Maybe that'd be more energy efficient. And so the first bit of collaboration is they would share a bit of their cytoplasmic DNA in a library, which became the nucleus. So it took 1 billion years to create a nucleus in a cell. And then, of course, once these single-celled organisms had a nucleus, they all started killing each other again. So it sort of reset. And another 1 billion years passed before bacteria went, maybe we ought to collaborate. Maybe that's more energy efficient to collaborate. So it took 2 billion years. And the second big leap forward was the second bit of collaboration was going from single-celled organisms to multi-celled organisms. And then eventually at some point, humanity emerged, the Homo sapiens as a multicellular organism. And of course, of all the multicellular organisms, human beings are more collaborative than anybody. So we are successful because we collaborate. But what's failed in COVID is a wonderful example of we just don't collaborate well enough yet. We're still learning how to do that well. So we're not sharing medical data properly. There is no common agreement internationally on how to report a COVID infection, how to report a COVID death. And so the stats around the world are very variable. There's no common sort of rule set about how to deal and how to stop viruses jumping from, in this case, rats and bats and ducks, we think, in the wet markets in Asia into humans. I mean, this is, you know, we've got history for this because that's what happened with HIV. It jumped from monkeys into humans. That's what happened with Ebola. That's what happened with SARS. And this is the fourth time in recent memory that we've had a virus jump from animals into humans. And we're not learning to take better care of food security in certain parts of the world. So we need to be way better at collaborating, but human beings are still massively struggling with that. And we just got to get better at it. Else we'll face, you know, 2-3 COVID infections a year if we're not careful. We've just got to get better.
Now, talking numbers, I mean, again, you know, I say if you're watching social media now, and I mean, I guess it depends. It depends whose content the algorithm's pushing in your direction. But, you know, many of the kind of posts I see at the moment really relate to the fact that, yes, the numbers of cases and confirmed cases may be going up, but the death toll's going down, and that kind of, you know, discrepancy is pushing further and further and further apart. I mean, is that the case? And if so, why are we moving to more extreme measures now if the death toll is going down?
Well, we've reached a point where it's very difficult to trust the data we've been given, even by our own government. Why? Because politics is awash and regressing globally into a deceitful position. And you can't get a straight answer out of anybody. You know, how can we trust these people when they themselves, including the chief medical officer, Dominic Cummings, you know, Boris himself, you know, actually are not even following their own guidelines? You know, how can we trust, you know, what they're saying to us? So it's very difficult to tell, to be perfectly honest. I mean, we've got a much greater incidence, but then we've got testing like we didn't have before. If you look at the data, it looks like, and then this, take this with a pinch of salt, it looks like the admission rate to hospital is increasing. So it looks like, you know, cases are on the rise, and therefore, you know, they're going, you know, this sort of let's go hard and let's go early seems to be the mantra, which some of the better countries did in the first wave, seems to be the strategy in the second wave. But there just isn't a rich quality debate going on amongst people, you know, who can collaborate effectively to give us wise guidance. We seem to be having shoot from the hip, make the policy up on the moment, on the fly, based on the last 10 minutes. We've got to get better.
And using, I mean, you talking hospital admissions, I guess, you know, that they're therefore implying severity or not here. I mean, again, taking this from personal experience, I mean, I was in France at the back end of the summer with some friends, with some family, and we came back to England, and basically the bubble, the containment unit we were in, not that we were containing, but you know, we were all on a boat together. Basically, we all came back to England and tested positive. Of the kind of 10 of us involved, you know, we were all in bed. Let's say, well, my daughter tested positive. You wouldn't have known any difference. The rest of us, we were in bed. Let's say anywhere between a day, a week. You know, we all had varying symptoms between, you know, between headaches and sore throats and stuff. But what I can say about it is, if the word corona did not, if we didn't know the word corona, we wouldn't even be talking about it. We'd be saying we came back to England. We've obviously all caught a bug because we've been in close confinement, felt a bit shitty, felt run down, you know. Depending on how manly or weak we felt, you know, dictated whether or not we fancied going to bed or fancied going to work. But, you know, for our unit, this was nothing worth talking about. This was a bit of flu that, you know, that we felt shitty coming back from holiday for. Mm. And we looked at it and think, how the hell is the world shutting down off the back of this? Now, were we lucky in mild circumstances or, you know, was our experience par for the course?
I think your experience is entirely par for the course. I mean, we've known from the get-go that the vast majority of people, particularly, you know, if you're under 70, get a mild infection. We've known that since the beginning. You know, but the whole strategy initially in the early days was to avoid, you know, a rising death rate. And all other factors, you know, the fact that it's, you know, our response may be worse than the actual problem in terms of the lag thing that we're going to get on mental health and the death from other causes because the hospitals haven't been functioned or have been massively distracted with COVID, you know, that's sort of largely ignored, not taken into the mix. The economic consequences not taken into the mix because the only thing that mattered was the death rate. And then what mattered is the overwhelm of the intensive care services because we didn't have enough ventilators because we hadn't properly prepared. So, again, our approach is too simplistic. You know, we've taken one factor, the death rate, as the only thing that matters. And so this is my sort of thesis, is that actually we need to take more things into consideration in terms of giving people proper guidance. This stuff matters. I mean, it's affecting millions of lives, not just in the UK, everywhere. And the suffering that's caused is not just through the increased death rate in those at risk. It's also the suffering of mental health problems, people feeling, and you're seeing an increasing spike on all that stuff, you know, and the economic pain that's going to, you know, be wreaked across the world. So we need to take all of that into account, not just the death rate. You know, we were upset by the simple death rate, and that was a mistake.
Well, that was going to be my next question to you, insofar as, I mean, do you think that the economic toll, and I mean, okay, you used the word mental health. I mean, whether we're talking about genuine mental health or whether we're talking, let's say, just human enjoyment, do you think the toll on those three things is now being completely outweighed with the necessity, you know, to look at the health risks here?
No, I mean, as I say, you've got to take all of this into account. You know, I'm not saying, well, you know, when in a sort of head-to-head, you know, would you rather have an elderly relative die from this disease or, you know, put up with some economic pain and suffering? We've got to take all of it into account, you know, so we'll only really know once we sort of get past all of this is to what has been the excess death rate in the at-risk population. How bad was it really? You know, so we've got to take that into account and then weigh that in, you know, against the increased death rate from people not getting appropriate treatment for their regular medical problems and the increased suicide rate, the increased self-harm rate, you know, the increased depression rate because people have lost their jobs and can't get another job. You know, and we should have been thinking about all of those factors when we plan a proper strategy. But all we were thinking about is the simple death rate. We just didn't take enough into consideration. And that's because we're taking too simplistic a view of what is an essentially incredibly complicated problem.
And how fair would it be to say that, look, you know, these are the risks. If you're someone at risk, if you're a vulnerable person, then we're advising you to isolate, or, you know, the precautions we're advising you to take. Everybody else, get on with it. And I asked the question from the perspective of, you know, look, I may be at the gung-ho end of the spectrum for most things in life, but I very much take the view that I would rather take my chances of catching it, even if that means death, than living a life where the restaurants close at 10 o'clock, where, you know, no one wants to give you a cuddle anymore, you know, where I have to walk around with a mask, etc., etc. Now again, I'm asking this question, let's say, from a purely selfish perspective, but I'm sure I'm not alone when I say it, that, you know, having experienced the last 38 and a half years of life in what we would call normality, you know, for me, if the new normal is the new normal, I'd rather take my chances and catch it.
Yeah, well, that's the debate we should have had back in. I mean, we knew this was coming, you know, back at the back end of last year, you know, and certainly, you know, January, February of this year. That is the exact debate. Now, if you look at some of the Scandinavian countries, they have taken much more of what's called a herd immunity approach in the way that you describe, which is protect those vulnerable people, those with pre-existing lung disease, the elderly, and so on. You know, and they can self-isolate and get their food delivered and so on. And we did a pretty good job as a nation protecting those people. So it didn't, you know, it was sort of slightly flattened the sombrero, you know, as Boris used to say. You know, we should have had that debate, you know, and decided as a nation, are we going to go down a herd immunity? You know, now people give a very strong argument that one death is one death too many. So it goes right to the heart of, well, what do we consider as important in society? You know, suffering is not just the suffering from the death of a loved one. It's all the other types of suffering that you've been talking about. And we're just highlighting now the economic suffering, the mental health suffering. We have to take all of those things into account in order to make an informed choice. And we simply didn't.
I think that is the problem. Like you say, you know, what one death is one death too many, but it's also, you know, it's also a completely unrealistic statement to make in the context of anything, really, because, you know, if we're going to live a life of one death is one death too many, then you know, we should never get in a car. Look, I don't want to die in a car accident, and I could prevent that by never getting in a car. But it's also not realistic, you know, like a realistic balance for my life. You know, I don't want my daughter to get kidnapped, and I could lock her in the bedroom until she's 55 years old. But it's not a realistic or fun way to live life. And I guess to me that's that balance that we're in right now. And again, it may be easy for me to say because I'm not vulnerable, because I haven't seen people close to me die. But I don't know. Again, you know, you can make as many analogies as you want, can't you? But I also think smoking, for example, if we talk about things that wind me up with this, if the government is so bothered about the deaths and the unnecessary deaths, then why do we allow smoking? I mean, that's a very clear one that no one is going to debate the figures on. Smoking kills both yourself and others through passive smoking.
Ultimately, Matt, that's about freedom of choice, right? Mm. People know what the risk is. In fact, smokers often overestimate the risk if you look at the research. But it's about freedom of choice. You know, we don't live in a totalitarian state. You know, people have choice, but we can't, you know, decide just based on our own personal. You know, we all live in a nation. You know, we all live in a community. So ultimately, it's the community's choice, not our individual choice. We can't leave it to individual discretion. We as a community have to make a decision. And that's essentially what the government is meant to be doing. They are our elected representatives who, you know, because we haven't got a system, unfortunately, yet, where, you know, we can all vote online right now about whether we want option A, which is, you know, a severe lockdown, or option B, the Matt Haycock, you know, herd immunity, you know, when we've taken care of the, you know, we can't vote online right now on which of those options and then follow, because we haven't got that system. What we've got is, you know, representatives in Parliament who are our proxy for making that decision. And I think this is, you know, by, you know, widespread view, they've been found somewhat wanting of being able to guide us effectively through the crisis. It's been a shambles, I think. But we are where we are, Matt. So we've got to now try and learn from, you know, what are the real lessons we can take away from this sort of shambolic handling is, you know, we've got to become more clued up about complex issues. And we've got to, you know, actually think about some of these things. Think about the way that the food system works globally, else we'll get another one of these viruses in a year or two, and then another one and another one. You know, so this is just the beginning. We've got to look how we, our elected representatives, do or don't represent the views. We've got to look at our own participation in this kind of decision making. So there are many things that need to come out of this that would get us to a better place. We can't continue to sit back passively, you know, finger pointing. We've got to become activists. We've got to take a more active role as citizens and try and change the system for the better, because otherwise we'll be on the receiving end of this kind of nonsense again and again and again. And the only way out of that is we become more actively engaged and try and make the system better. And I mean that the health system and the way the, you know, global health system, that we communicate more effectively with each other across nation states, collaborate, you know, in that way, and look at the way that the political system works better, look at the way that the economic system works better, because there's plenty of data showing that, you know, some of the most impoverished areas have the highest COVID rate. So this is not just about the sort of health system. This is about poverty in the UK. And if you certainly look at other nation states where poverty levels are high, they have a much higher infection rate. So there are all sorts of things that we really need to look at. And if we're going to sort of create a better future, we have to lean into some of these big, complicated issues. Part of the difficulty is the people who we've elected are not sufficiently sophisticated to deal with the level of complexity that's now being created.
And just before we came online, we talked about both of your books that you'd written during lockdown. One of them, I forget the title, but it's something like Truth in a World of Lies, or
Be Honest, Reclaiming the Truth in a World that Lies. That's one of them. Yeah.
Honest. Can you tell me a bit about the content of that and maybe particularly how it may apply to the last 6 months of our lives?
I mean, there's a new normal in politics, Donald Trump, bless his heart, has sort of set a new standard, even within the White House. People are going, my God, it's chaos. Sort of the ability of people today to lie. I mean, 10 years ago, people would have fallen on their sword and resigned for the kind of behavior. It's a new normal of deceit. And it sort of seems to be currency. If you look at Jeffrey Epstein, I mean, lied his way into the banking system. We're awash with people around us, lying. And it's the extent of the lying and the scale of the lying is unbelievable. That book is about, we have to reclaim the truth. We have to stop lying to each other. We have to stop lying to ourselves. We have to understand the nature of truth. Truth is a very interesting thing. They're basically, one goes into court and to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. But there are actually three truths. And a lot of people don't realize this. There's my truth, what I believe to be true. There's the collective shared truth. And then there's the observable truth, independent of anybody's opinion. And most people don't realize that. They think there is just a truth. So what happens is people get confused. They think my truth is the truth. And it isn't. My truth is my truth. It's my view of the world. It's not the truth. People have to start understanding these subtleties because they make a profound difference. So when we, go into court and we're trying to, a court is there to try and establish the truth. Establishing the truth, we call witnesses, and witnesses give us a view of, oh, I was there at the time, Your Honor, and what I saw was, in sort of some slightly foggy or relatively clear memory of the moment, and we're taking it as gospel. Well, that's a subjective truth. It's not an absolute truth. It's a subjective truth. And so we hear witnesses from, and then we have 12, the jury of 12 people, which then create a shared truth, which is used as a proxy for the truth. The phenomenon of truth is quite a complicated thing. And we have to understand that, because if we don't understand that, we're in this post-truth world where, certainly politicians, but many people in power are deliberately lying. Engaging in what we call these seven deadly arts of deception. So, they're distracting you. So it's that classic magician thing, don't watch my hand, watch this other thing, and they're distracting you. And you see politicians do this all the time. Yes, I'm not going to answer your question. I'm going to say something else. Or the most simplistic thing is, let's just ruffle Boris's hair. So everybody then talks about his ruffled hair or, Jeremy's crumpled suit. Or previously Theresa May's shoes. That's just a distraction from the truth. And of course, people who don't want you to find out the truth love that, because you don't get to the real truth. They're distracting you. So they can distract you, they can distort, they can disrupt, they can discredit, they can displace, they can create doubt, and then they can cherry pick the data or discard the truth. So these are the seven deadly arts of deception.
But it's quite interesting as well that in today's world, I mean, it's almost a contradiction or a paradox insofar as we talk about the fact that with the internet, with social media, with the transparency of information, the likes of the WikiLeaks, etc., in theory, never have we had a more transparent and truthful world. Yet, like you say, never has the level of protection been greater.
Well, and that's the times we live in, right? Which is why people have to knowledge up and wise up, because we're living in a world of paradox right now. We're more connected through social media than we've ever been in the history of mankind, but we feel more disconnected, right? That's interesting. Right. We're more knowledgeable, but there's more deceit. There's all these emergencies flaring up. I mean, you know, before COVID, Australia was on fire. You know, before that, you know, we got the Brexit debacle, which is still bubbling away in the background. You know, so there's all these emergencies, you know, before that, Extinction Rebellion. And you know, there's these emergencies going on at the same time as there's an emergence of much greater levels of wisdom. So you've got an emergency and an emergence at the same time. So these are sort of, we're in this world now, and this is the new normal. It's paradoxical. We're more connected and disconnected at the same time. There's an emergency and emergence at the same time. You know, there's more access to truth, but more disinformation at the same time. This is the world we're now in. And therefore, the only way to cope with this really complicated world is we have to get smarter. We have to wise up, and we have to set down and adhere to some principles like being honest. So in the book, we write about, you know, humanity, the hack for humanity, which is four things. Hack is an acronym for honesty, appreciation, curiosity, and kindness. So we do well if we embrace those four elements. You know, we actually started to be way more honest with each other, but doing that with kindness. I mean, that was Caroline Flack's message, right? Be kind. You know, I'm just going to be brutally honest. Would you like me to be honest? Well, not if it means you're going to be unkind. No, I don't want you to be honest. You're going to be unkind. But I'd like you to be honest if you're going to be kind at the same time. So honesty with kindness, you know, an appreciation of our lives, an appreciation of, you know, and this is what David Attenborough was doing about the natural world. I mean, he gave a very inspiring comment recently, you know, when asked, you know, what's the one thing he would recommend to humanity? And he said, appreciate the natural world and stop wasting. You know, and I thought that was really inspirational. So we need to appreciate our own lives, appreciate the gift of being alive, appreciate the planet and the natural world on another whole level. Stop being so consumptive, because, you know, we're all sort of up in arms about the fact that we're going to get, you know, the 1% death rate of humanity. But humanity has been eradicating other species 1% a year for the last 20 years. And so now, you know, we're going to get that happening to us. And we're way too sort of human-centric in our view. We're sharing the planet with many, many millions of species, and we need to be more appreciative of the natural world, as David Attenborough exhorted us, and be more curious about, well, how do we live on this planet with all these other species? How do we live in harmony, stop being so consumptive, and how do we get a balanced thing? So we need to be more curious about that. And there is a way forward. We can do it. And I'm, you know, an eternal optimist. But we need to be much more curious about that and knowledge up and wise up and start to fix these profoundly broken systems. And there are many of them.
Perfect. Well, listen, Alan, I certainly appreciate you for having your time here and for answering many of my curiosities. I'm sure the guys listening and watching both now and if anyone watches this after the fact is going to certainly get some of their questions answered and comments either validated or answered as well. So for anyone else who wants to catch up on your books, find your books, hear more from you, just tell us where we can find them and give you some.
You can just Dr. Alan Watkins, you know. Google me, you know, you'll find my TED Talks online. Complete-curiosity.com is our website. You know, there's loads of resources out there, all of them free. You'll find me on Facebook, you know, I'm on Instagram slightly. I don't really know how Instagram works, but I'm on there. but just reach out, you know, we're very open and receptive. And the good news in all of this, Matt, is we've got to remain optimistic. Is, you know, we've still got a chance of turning this round, but we have to wise up and we have to start to change ourselves, change the way we relate to each other and change what we're doing. And if we do that, then we've got a chance of making a much better future for all of us.
Perfect. Well, listen, thanks again for being here, Alan. Guys watching and listening, I hope you enjoyed that. If you don't already subscribe to my podcast and my YouTube channel, make sure you jump over there and do that now. There's another great interview that Alan and I did 6 or 7 months ago, and I've got plenty more interviews about and conversations about Corona and interviews and meetings with business leaders, celebrities and other inspiring people. So if you like this, I'm sure you'll love that content too. But again, thanks a lot for watching and listening. Alan, thanks a lot for being here, and I hope we're going to catch up and do this again soon.
Yeah. Okay, Matt, take care and look after Yorkshire.
Thank you for listening to the Matt Haycock Show. For more Matt, check out his YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Matt Haycock. Or go stalk him on Instagram and Twitter, the Matt Haycock. And we'll see you soon.